What's up, I'm Beyonce.
Yeah, this is Big Snoop D-O-double-G.
Hi, this is Kelly Clarkson.
Stick around for more conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
So today, we have to talk with us on Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, Aaron Muller. Now, Aaron is the CEO and he's a therapist at Life Matters, where he works alongside his wife, Dr. Trudy Ann Gale. Aaron, you're also a certified school social worker for the Department of Education and a behavioral health consultant for Kings County anti-violence programs. But prior to this, this is where you provided counseling to teens and adults battling substance abuse. So Aaron, thank you for joining us here on Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. And I mentioned to you before that I'm very excited about having this conversation with you, because one thing is I'm very passionate about is mental health, a good mental health, but also mental health in the Black community, because my own history, my own story, I know too many people that have been institutionalized with mental health challenges. And so that's one of the things I want to talk about and address with you, especially is the mental health of men and of color and the stigma attached to that. There's always been stigma attached to it. Now, with everything that's been happening in the world, the pandemic, the murder that we all saw live broadcast, this has actually led to the lid being lifted just a little bit on systemic racism. And it's inevitable that there's going to be a level of anxiety that comes with that. So do you think that there is a sense that men of color still have to keep shrugging things off like that when they see it, just to keep it moving? And what does that do to the state of the mental health of a man of color to see something like that?
Right, that, and watching it, first of all, watching over and older, over and over again, can be very, very unhealthy and traumatizing and re-traumatizing. And we don't really realize that. So we really have to be mindful and censor what we allow our body to and what our eyes to see. Mm-hmm. So, and if you don't acknowledge and don't identify it and you kind of keep it and hold it in, that's very dangerous. So you're holding on to the anxiety, holding on to that anger, and that can result in, you know, depression and aggression. And the sad part is that we let it out in very unhealthy ways and on people that we love and care about the most, unfortunately. So, I mean, the world that we live in now, where mental health has shifted so greatly, I feel like you are under a rock if you have not had a conversation, if you've not heard about it. This is a movement that I'm so happy about. When I first started out in the field of social work, it really wasn't a conversation. It was still kind of taboo to kind of talk about it. It wasn't on social media as prevalent as it is now. And I used my Facebook and Instagram platforms to post articles, post quotes, post information. And I really didn't have a kind of like, okay, I want to meet this mass. I want to meet this. But it was just, let me just put this information out there. I felt very led to do that. And it's kind of like, if people are spiritual, believing that, I kind of felt like there's my calling to do. And it was kind of just very automatic, kind of just using my Instagram. I was using it first just for pictures, and I wanted to think of a creative name to kind of identify myself. So I came up with the Black Therapist, and that kind of led me to where I am today, where people, if they see me on the street, hey, you're the Black Therapist sometimes. But I really wanted to emphasize, and I felt it was very important that people see that there is a Black male therapist that is relatable and young, and even when I get old, still young, and understand where you're coming from, and how important it is that just because I don't have to know what you've been through or anything like that, but I can empathize with you and you feel a connection in terms of I can let my guard down. I can be vulnerable with this person because, oh, wow, he dressed the way I do, or he speaks the vernacular the way that I do, or he comes from the same island that I do. Like all of these connections that make persons of color feel much more comfortable with wanting to speak with someone. We need to feel connected, especially something as sensitive as mental health, to want to talk to somebody. So that was kind of why I started on this journey. But for men, I feel like the narrative has shifted a little bit, mm-hmm. and they are hearing about it, but it's still making that decision. Say, I want to talk to somebody. So every time I do get a call or someone reaches out, I always find out what led them to finally call. And generally, what I hear commonly is, you know, I've been thinking about it for some time, or I've been seeing your posts, or I, you know, somebody, you know, sent me something you wrote, and I was like, I messed with that dude, and it still took me a long time to call. And I tell him, well, that's the greatest thing. I'm glad to hear that you called and stuff. So I believe while there is taboo and while there is kind of this shame about wanting help, in the back of a lot of brothers' mind, they know that they need somebody to talk to. It's just making that call. Same like going to the gym. We know we need, it's just making that, myself included, is making that final step. You know what? Let me go sign up. It's time. And when you can talk to yourself and tell yourself, okay, now it's time. So I feel like for a lot of brothers, you know, and there's a spectrum, those that are, there is totally unaware and whether it's in denial or the defense mechanism or just complete, just not in this atmosphere. And then along the spectrum, those who know and need that support and that push, those who kind of like in contemplation, not really, if you think about the stages of change, you know, pre-contemplation, you know, so there's, I feel like it kind of teeters with those two, with pre-contemplation and contemplation.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that you were saying that when they see you and it puts them at ease because growing up, so we've both grown up with parents from West Indian Islands, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, it's one of those things where the slightest little thing you do, the way it's like, what do you mind?
Right.
and so that's like it's, and for those that are not that don't understand, it's what's wrong with you? Are you mad?
Right.
So, and then so growing up, you hear that. So you think the slightest little thing that you do is just like, and then for us, where I grew up, there was a mental hospital called Shenley. So it was always anything you did, you were threatened with being taken there.
Yeah.
So again, growing up, it kind of just put the fear of God into you about you can't exhibit anything. And not just exhibit, if anything was going on for you, you kind of had to keep it down, hold it down, because they're going to say you're mad and they're going to take you gently, right? And they're going to have you locked up. So that's another reason why I was excited to talk to you today, so that people can see someone that looks like them, that they can go to, no judgments, and get the help that they need. Because it's one of the things I found out, and I found this out years ago, that there's an alarming rate of young black men that have been institutionalized with mental challenges. And it just makes me wonder, in your professional opinion, what would you say that some of the causes that contribute to this disproportionate number of black men, and because there are some black women, let's not just think that we're all superwomen, but that black men suffering from mental health issues?
Well, you think about the kind of the history of systemic racism and oppression and trauma, and how trauma can kind of mimic, in terms of the symptoms, how that could mimic mental health disorders and things like that, and how people are wrongly diagnosed or misdiagnosed all the time and automatically sent into hospitals where there could have been alternative measures that could have been taken. If you look at the hierarchy of needs, did you like assess if their needs are met. Do they have water? Do they have the basic needs met? We, if you look at the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, are the basic needs met? Maybe that's why, you know, they're the way they are with poverty and not getting enough sunlight that can cause anxiety. Like there's a number of factors that may not just always be mental health that, that people are going through that could be treated. If you just ask what's going on, you know, if they're in need, are they hungry, nutrition imbalance, you know, there's some women where they're in their menstrual cycle that can cause, you know, so it depends on the, if you capture the time when you're right, it could cause an imbalance and things like that. So if you capture the time, what the person is going through by asking questions, then that can kind of alleviate a lot of things. So it's, I guess it's having presence of mental health, professionals in particular settings, which, you know, social workers are constantly advocating for, so they could assess and not always quickly treat with medication or treat with hospitalization.
That's interesting, because you saying that just made me stop to think then, really, that's just a lazy way of doing it, to just, you know, just move them along onto the next case, right? Just
right, so, right. So
mental health illness, hospitalized, medication, gone.
Right. So I'm when someone comes in for the first time, I'm assessing, you know, when's the last time you went to the doctor. In social work school, we look at the various like spheres. We look at the bio, you know, psychosocial, right? So I'm looking at when's the last time you had a medical workup, because sometimes depressive symptoms could be from a medical standpoint. So I'm asking, especially for my older clients, when you had blood work done, when's the last time, you know, how's your vitamin levels and things like that, because those are also very, very important. Some mental health conditions can be from a medical standpoint.
Okay.
So very important. So when you don't do that, we automatically go already to the mental health. You know, that can one cause stigma. The person's like, I know there's nothing wrong with me, but you also caring about the entire body. Mm-hmm. And that's from a holistic approach. So looking at the various, looking at poverty, looking at trauma, what they've been through, all of that, what they experienced.
That's again, very interesting, because I have shared this story before. Many years ago, I dated a guy, and at the time when we first met, I didn't know that he had manic depression, also known as bipolar disorder. And the way that it was diagnosed is he used to smoke weed. So he went to his friend and he says, roll me a spliff, roll me a joint. And the friend laced it with LSD.
Right.
So then he had a really bad trip from it. And because he had a bad trip from it, he was immediately labeled as having manic depression. When in the reality then, it might not even have been that, but then he was completely just, I remember seeing him so heavily medicated, it was like he was a zombie.
Right. So oftentimes, and that's oftentimes that happened to our brothers, where their substance-induced psychosis. So they were perfectly fine. And then sometimes their marijuana is laced with something. And the other component is a predisposed mental health condition. So when you mix those two together, oftentimes the person, you know, with, and I'm not a medical doctor, but this is just from my training and from my expertise, that's kind of like the elixir for that substance-induced psychosis. And that's what causes that. You know, sometimes you see very odd behavior and talking to themselves or you know, depressive symptoms, all of that, but from a substance-induced psychosis. So it may not be, but it, like I said, may be underlying, but it could be a stressor, a traumatic experience, or something like being laced with a substance that can kind of set it on, the onset.
Wow, because now that you've mentioned that, this was 20 years ago. So it's just made me think, I wonder if he really did have that, or again, going back to what you were saying, because they didn't look at him from a holistic view. It was just get that rubber stamp out, stamp mental illness. And this one looks like, okay, he's not talking to himself, so he doesn't look schizophrenic, bipolar, and just ship him off.
Right. And oftentimes, where we don't have the resources to kind of go to a state-of-the-art facility, or, you know, sometimes it's in the ER, you know, and it may not, depends on the area of where you live. You may not get the best follow-up care or follow-up support. You may not follow up with routine mental health treatment, because after, for example, his diagnosis, he would need to follow up because he may have a diagnosis from there on out because of the laced substance that caused the onset of those symptoms. So he may have those symptoms now, but it was from a substance induced. And that's an actual diagnosis, you know, from that standpoint. And now he has those symptoms, but it needs to be addressed ongoing. And I often find that that's not the case with our brothers. So I've actually had clients who, when I did kind of the family history and kind of did the demographic information, I found out that that's what's actually occurred. So your story is not unfamiliar at all. I've had a few cases of that. And being that I'm in a private practice setting, I'm always mindful about the capacity of clients that I take on. Mm-hmm. So if it's something where there's active, really active symptoms, then you need to ensure that you can manage that as a clinician. Because it also might need a medication piece, so that to kind of deal with any exhibiting behaviors that needs to be managed as well. So I would connect them with a psychiatrist that can kind of monitor their medication as well as with the therapy. And if I can refer them to some place that have it as a one-stop shop in the same place, then I would do that, because they need to confer, the therapist and the psychiatrist, on how he's doing or she's doing.
Well, because, you know, and all of the things that you're saying, because it's really got me thinking, because I mean, I had my set questions, but now you kind of just thrown me, now you just got me thinking, because, you know, when I think about it, and when you're saying, because for a lot of black men or men of color, that follow-up, that aftercare.
It's critical. It's critical and crucial that it is maintained, that is ongoing. And like you said, that is the biggest challenge, the ongoing care. If there is any financial issues, you know, continuation of care is one of the biggest hurdles, because now they're hopping from place to place. Say if they're a nomad, you know, they don't have a place to stay. You know, medications sometimes need to be in the fridge. You need to go to CVS or whatever pharmacy, Duane Reade, you need an address. Like, all of those things that we take for granted may not be available because of various situations that they're in. Is this financial situations, they're not in a steady place. They have to be in a shelter where you have to leave at a certain time and come back at a certain time. Or if they're on their own and renting a room, it's not an active address, you know, it's not their address, but they just have a place to stay, staying with relatives. You know, there's so many factors when we talk about this specific case. So family support and services and resources is very important, but the individual has to follow up, and it has to be that inner drive, that inner kind of
want to do so
on an ongoing basis.
And you've had two questions that I actually had for you. You've touched on both of them, and one of them was, what would you say the biggest challenges facing the Black community when it comes to mental health care?
Well, one big thing we talked about was the stigma. Another thing popular is if you're coming from a Christian based spirituality, and that juggle between, God and going to therapy or acknowledging, do you submit and leave it at the altar and pray on it? And, or do you take the active steps to pray on it and then also seek therapy and get the help that you need? So a lot of people kind of struggle with that. So I feel like those are kind of the two major things in terms of, like, maybe denial, or, you know, I'm just going to pray on it and God is going to see everything through, which he will. But there's also other pieces and blessings that he's bestowed upon us, such as Christian-based therapists that you can talk to and things like that.
And it's interesting that you should say that, because coming from a Christian upbringing myself, it's one of those things where, because I stopped going to church for many, many years, because it was one of those where you would go to the elders, like you read your Bible, as we're taught to do, right? But when you have questions, it's go and pray, go and read your Bible. But that's what I have questions about.
Right.
Is somebody going to help me? So I kind of just like, when I was 18, I just, in my mind, it was just like, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. I'm out of here. And but then many times you see, and I remember growing up that you would see people coming into church. You could clearly see that they were out of their mind or mental health issues. But rather than get them the help, it's like you said, pray about it, drive the demon out of them. Yeah, but guess what? God gave everybody wisdom. We've all been given wisdom to know what to do. And also, it's one of those things where that's not helpful. It's not helpful to just say to somebody who's struggling, because if you're struggling mentally, I don't think you're going to be able to pray properly. I'm just throwing that one out there.
So you definitely need to assess where they're at. So if they're cognitively not even aware or cognitively present, then to do something as to be able to pray would be very, very challenging for them. So I think we kind of say things out of just form of fashion, like, oh, I'm praying for you. Are you really praying for the person? Or really assess, we're like, wow, you really don't look like yourself. Maybe we need to do a little bit more than that. I feel like as we are transitioning into this new world, with mental health being at the forefront of a lot of conversations, that there has been a shift even in the church, that a lot of pastors are acknowledging, talking about it, on the pulpit about how important it is to address your mental health. There are a lot of pastors that are actually mental health mental health clinicians as well. I know, a few that are very relevant on social media as well, that, have that both skills that they're blessed with, to be able to preach about the gospel and also talk about mental health as well, and have, meaningful conversations with their parishioners about mental health. I'm very grateful in my church as well. They've allowed me many, many opportunities during Bible college to have actual courses where they asked my wife and myself to come in and talk about mental health. I've had, forums and conversations numerous times. So my bishop and my pastor is very open about it and allowed me to come in and speak to the parishioners about it. So there's a lot of churches that are open and honest about it. And like I always say, everything ain't for everybody. So there's some that are still kind of like, no, it's not real. And there's some people on an individual level who think mental health is not, or mental health issues is not real. And you can't win everybody over. And it's not about winning, but about being informed and having the information for those who need it. And that's kind of like my stance. So I don't think it's like the whole world is going to change, but I feel like there has been such a shift that when people ask me about the stigma of mental health, I honestly, in my heart of hearts, I'm not even so focused on the stigma as much. I feel like it's still there and it's going, but it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Media, athletes is talking about it. You name it. Everybody's talking about it. It's not one of those things where it's like, at the dinner table. This is being talked about at barbecues and dinner tables. And we have people in social media that display these behaviors that actually allow for these conversations to happen.
I'm so glad you said that, because I remember growing up, and I'm not ashamed to say this, I do have members of my family that suffer from mental health issues. But the way that they were treated, to this day, it's heartbreaking. They were never spoken about, and it's like, and it's funny, because when you ask how they're doing, everybody starts shuffling around, look like they're looking for something to change the subject.
Right.
No, how are they? Because I'm thinking to myself, Okay, because like, I got a cousin, that's first cousin, who suffers from schizophrenia. I have another first cousin who is, she's a resident in a facility because she went through a traumatic experience and it affected her mental health.
Right.
And but my thing is, as far as I'm concerned, obviously if it wasn't for this, I would call them by name. I have no problem calling by name and saying my cousin so-and-so. You know, so you saying that with, like, people are no longer doing that, that is such, so refreshing to hear, because that's what a lot of us grew up with.
Yeah, and it's still, and it's still pockets of it. You know, there's still pockets of it in certain families, like, shh, don't say nothing. You know.
They don't exist.
but, and I'm going to speak into existence that we have to, you know, I hope people that are listening to this start to change those conversations, start to talk about it, and make those changes. I think through social media, you see people writing about, and I've been feeling this. If you look at, you know, the latest artist that had a, she was hospitalized on, and on social media, a lot of people are sharing their stories, talking about their experiences and just relating to them. Like, I've been through that. And I feel like when people see someone in a spotlight, show their vulnerability like that, it also allows them to kind of feel open enough to share. And it may not be with their family member, but it may be with a friend that they shared that they felt this way, or they felt like they wanted to hurt themselves or something like that.
You keep doing this to me, Aaron. You keep touching on my questions. And just so everybody knows, I didn't pre-share my questions with you. So, because that's two things I wanted to touch on. Because I had seen and read about Tamar Braxton and the latest Kanye West. And, you know, I tell you what really hurt. You've got those people that have been so supportive, so encouraging. But then you also have the memes and the jokes. It's like, man, it's not funny.
Right.
It's not funny. And the other thing I wanted to touch on, because I want to get your views on both of these, is please explain. I mean, I know how important it is, but I think people need to hear how important a good support network is, especially for our men of color that have seen things like the George Floyd thing. They've seen like the Philando Castillo and all those things. So just those two things. What are your views on like Kanye and Tamar and support networks?
Oh, so
somebody was going to go there, right?
Right. I'm always very mindful with, I can give my impressions. And I see in the world, there's a lot of therapists out there that hasn't gone to school or have the debt that us therapists accumulate, but they have a lot of information that they see. And I always want to get more insight before I can make an assessment. Because I always like to ask questions. In my personal life, I am an absolute mute. Because my wife is like, who do I talk to so much? And you don't talk. I don't talk. I'm really not a talker, but when it comes to my profession, I want to know questions. So I wouldn't.
Because it's your passion.
Right. This is my passion. And when God uses you to do your passion, you do things that are completely out of your norm. Because usually I'm not a talker. At a party or a barbecue, I would be in the corner blending in with the barbecue pit. You're like, you wouldn't see me. But when it comes to mental health issues and forums, I'm at the forefront, you know? Mm-hmm. So. Saying all that to say that with those two artists, I would definitely need more information and feedback. I do know that in that limelight, having the world at your oyster creates a different set of demons and a different set of battles on top of things that you had to deal with growing up, because you're still a human, but when you're at that level, there's so many different things that's coming at you and powers that be.
That the fact you live in a fishbowl as well.
And the fact that you can't do anything, if you know what I'm saying, if you want to dig up your nose, you can't do anything without somebody, you know, in your face. And that does something to you, I feel like. That does something to, like, as a human. There's certain things that are, like, just normalized, I feel like. And that level of of stardom. I always felt that way, and I always feel kind of this compassion for artists and people in the limelight, because I'm like, that's a different set of battles. People talking crap about you all day long, don't know you.
I don't even know you.
Writing this, saying the nastiest. People don't even write. If they post a picture sipping on coffee, people will, you know, would say find the meanest thing from the bottom of their belly.
Oh, get it.
This, I'm like, you have to be some kind of person to find something mean to say when somebody's just sipping coffee and taking a picture. So that shows a lot about where you're at mentally as well, and unhappy, because in my brain, I can't even formulate something like that. So when you have to deal with that on an ongoing basis, people that are unhappy as well, and then impose that on you, has to do something to you. So
I like that. People that are unhappy themselves and they're imposing that on you.
Yeah, I mean, if you believe in vibes, you know what I'm saying? And the rest of you talk about juju, like, you know, just don't want those negative vibes, as they call it, right? Right. Keep it. I don't want that around me, you know? So when you think about that, how that day after day you really have to be really, really strong. Mm. You really have to have a strong support network, a huge, strong belief in whatever higher power that is that you believe in to lean on and cast your troubles to, in addition to therapy, to talk about what you're going through and experiencing. So I'm wondering if those two artists have that. We see that they may have come, you know, have family, but they still apparently feel very alone. I could say for Tamar, maybe feel very alone. And felt like this is I can't manage this. This is unbearable, despite having everyone. So you can have a whole bunch of people around you and still feel alone.
That is so very true. And it's, you touched on it again, having that support network around you. Because I remember when I was dating that guy 20 years ago, his family, listen, those doctors could not give that man anything without his family researching it. Because there was some medications they wanted to give him. And I remember his sister, his younger sister in particular, she'd be like getting it, writing it down, going researching it and all the rest of it. So that, because I feel like in part, the support network is for the actual person. So that, you know, look, you have us, and we got you. It's a two-way thing here. But also, going back to what we were saying about physicians sometimes just being lazy, so that they know, hold on, this person isn't just out here by themselves.
Right.
They have a support network. They have a family. So you can't just do anything you want.
Right.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. If I think about even in the medical system, you know, if you have someone in the hospital just for any routine medical treatment or emergency or things like that, being knowledgeable to be able to advocate on behalf of your family member is really, really, really important. So they can't run the okey-doke on you and just say certain things. No, you don't do that. No, this is what we're asking for, advocating and knowing your rights and things. So I feel like that's really, really important. I had an uncle that was in a nursing home, and we would do routine between myself and my mom and my grandmother. They never know who was going to show up. And he didn't want the food in there. He wanted his rice and peas. And
can't blame uncle for that.
Right. So we would ensure that, you know, Sunday he would have that, you know, we would wash his clothes. So they know that they would see me coming with the laundry bag and I was taking his clothes so he could get washed. So they knew that you didn't mess around with Trevor, but because they know that somebody was coming. You never know who was going to show up.
Or when.
So, and then my mom and grandmother works in the hospital. So they are very knowledgeable.
Mm.
So that you can't run. And then I'm a social worker. So they knew.
Mm.
So everybody don't have that luxury of having resources or having the knowledge base, you know? So it's unfortunate that people are taking advantage of just from not having the knowledge.
Yeah, that is very true. And to be honest, I've seen it because I remember I visited him through two hospitalizations and just seeing all those other people that just didn't have anybody and were just treated any kind of way while they were in these facilities. And it was heartbreaking to see. And as a person, because back then we're talking about what? And we're talking about 20 years ago. I didn't know what I know now.
Right.
So I must admit, I was a little bit afraid of some of them because some of them can be violent. Let's not kid ourselves. Some can be violent. And then I didn't want them to get attached to me. And the next thing you know, listen, once he was out, I'm gone.
Right.
So it's as you said, there's some people that just don't have that. And it's very, very sad. And so you as a mental health professional and a social worker, tell me, in an ideal world, what is it that you would like to see in the field of mental health and how mental health is, how people are just taken care of?
So my goal is someone asked me, what do I want to be seen as, or what is my legacy? And it's to normalize mental health in the African American community and kind of let everyone know that it's okay to acknowledge if things are not well with you, and to establish what wellness looks like for you. Mm-hmm. That everybody has a wellness kit of what, identifying what makes me feel good. What are some healthy things that make me feel good? And how can I ensure that I allow it to happen on an ongoing basis, so I'm not killing myself with work and not maintaining that balance. And I think that's something that I emphasize a lot with African-American men. Those that I see in session are, you know, their husbands, their fathers, their business owners. They work, you know, for several jobs and just, you know, supporting their family, supporting themselves. And what do you do to be well? What do you do to make sure that you're okay? And they kind of, I don't know, or no, nah, I'm good. You know, they're kind of like, I'm good. And I'm like, you're doing a lot. And I always hear like, no, I'm not doing that much. And I'm like, that's very scary because I'm always acknowledging like, yo, I'm doing a lot. Like I'm doing a lot. My wife and I say, yo, what are we doing? We're doing a lot. And when you can, I feel like, acknowledge, and we're not complaining, it's just acknowledging that we're doing a lot. If, you know, we have businesses, we have children, you know, we both work. Acknowledging that we're doing a lot, it kind of gives us a pulse that, oh, well, we better take time to do, you know, take a vacation, you know, for the weekend, or acknowledge that maybe that's why I'm feeling agitated. Maybe that's acknowledging why I'm feeling tired, or I'm being short with a loved one, or I'm being short with my child. When we don't kind of see, like with this lens, see this mirror that you have your business hustle on the side, you have your main job, you have three children, you have your house, you have your mortgage, you have an ill parent, you have the sandwich generation, you know, you're taking care of your uncle, you know, down the street. If you're just going, and you don't recognize how much you're doing, you're going to start to exhibit symptoms, or you're exhibiting symptoms and don't even realize why you're short, why you're depressed, why you're angry, why you're upset, why you're not sleeping right, why you're not eating well, why you're gaining weight, because you're doing so much. So when I tell bro, I'm like, bro, you're doing a whole bunch, man. Like, what are you doing for yourself? I hear great things. Like, and how are you compartmentalizing it? Are you setting a little schedule for yourself? Like, okay, I've worked, the kids are good, now it's me time. But being intentional about the lives that we're living instead of being so automatic.
I'm glad you said that, because that's one of the things I really wanted to touch on with you about what you would say are the steps that people need to put in place to maintain a healthy, well-balanced life and good mental health. So I'm glad you said, I'm so glad you touched on that.
Yeah. And I always tell them it's not perfect. Balance to me does not mean perfect. Mm-hmm. Balance to me is that you acknowledging, okay, I've been working. Some of my bills is paid. I think I have to pay one next week. Hopefully that my lights will get turned off, but let me ensure that I do something for me.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be an expensive self-care, but acknowledging that I've done this. Did you go for a run? Did you call and have a Zoom party with your family that lives across the country just to touch base and have some fun? Like that balance. We can be an all or nothing society.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So it's either we either drop all our responsibilities and we're in Cancun with our mortgage money, or we are working our fingers to the bone and not doing anything.
I live in a big house, right?
Right. And it doesn't have to be all or nothing. It's like little things in between, a little nugget to look forward to. And self-care does not have to be expensive poofs that you drop in water. It does not have to be an expensive massage at $200. Some of the best self-care items is low cost or free.
I like that. And the final thing that I want to ask you is children, because you touched on the therapy that you're doing with children. And that's something that I wanted to ask you is, what can we do to almost catch them early to help children of color, especially, develop good mental health as they grow into adolescence and adulthood, so that we can really stop and combat the rising number of black men that are institutionalized in mental health facilities?
You know what, Allison? And when I do a lot of couple kid sessions, I include the parents. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they want to just drop them off and they wait in the waiting room on Instagram. I'm like, no, come here. I need to talk to you too. Because oftentimes, what is the parent modeling? What is the parent displaying? So a lot of when...
Hold on, wait, stop. Say that part again.
A huge part when working with children is what the parent is modeling. What are they seeing? What are they exposed to? What is the language? What is the atmosphere like? And when I have children with attention issues, let me see what the house look like. Because if the house is chaotic and a hot mess, what do you think their brain is going to process? It needs to be ordered. It needs to be structure. And a lot of the work that I do is organizing, emphasizing the importance of the bedroom should be a certain type of organization. And let's have charts. Let's have boards with expectations of rules, regulations, what their chores is, everything. And that's organization, because their brain, and it may not be ADHD, it's just that the house is a hot mess and there's a lot of chaos.
And so that's it. So many are being diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, and given medications.
And it's just the parents are not organized, so we have unorganized children. And like I said, it's not perfection, but there's a certain expectation. When the kids them come home, all right, they know, say it's 4 o'clock. What are you supposed to do? Your book bag should have a snack. And now it's time to get the books. By 7 o'clock, work, 8 o'clock, hopefully work. And it's not a finite rule, but it's a certain structure. So they know. My 3-year-old knows by 10 o'clock, he's asking if he want his milk. He like his little milk before bed. So he knows that there's a certain everyday type of routine. And when you emphasize that and kind of implement that, the kids know that life is kind of just routines. Because as an adult, you have a routine. You go to work, you come home. So you start to instill those things in them. But if it's a laissez-faire, fly by the seat of your pants, then we have those type, you know, children, and that manifests into various behaviors in the classroom where they're required to have structure.
Right. Thank you so much, because that is something that I really wanted to touch on. And that makes so much sense. I didn't even connect those dots. If the household is chaotic, that child's mind's going to be chaotic. So
oftentimes,
the child doesn't need medication. The child needs just some structure and sometimes even a little bit of responsibility.
I emphasize that too. So they're 9 years old. What's up with the chores? Oh, they don't really do nothing. Oh, well, we're going to change that. So they're going to have garbage. or something. So I kind of change those narratives, change those conversations around what the expectations for the children are, and to build esteem and build productivity, they need to have some type of role. They need to have some in terms of in this household. It's not just about you getting PS4s and fives and Jordans. There is a role and responsibility, a part of this household, where community, that there's an expectation that you're going to help to ensure that the, you know, the maintain the maintenance of this house.
That's good. Thank you. So, Aaron, thank you. Thank you. So tell us, what are your specialties? What types of therapy does your clinic perform, offer, and where can people find you?
So my name is Aaron Muller. I can be seen at the black underscore therapist on Instagram, primarily on there. I also have a podcast called Aaron Talks. And right now I'm doing the Husband Files series. So my platform of Aaron Talks is Therapy Out in the Open. So it's what therapy would look like. And I have guests on there, and we're having real dialogue about some of the concerns that they have in, or just about what I've seen in my practice. Mm-hmm. And right now I'm dealing with husbands, whether they've been married 1 year or 20 years, 50 years, and talking about what their strengths are and what they want to work on.
Excellent. And sorry, can you just say again where people can find you? So it's
the black underscore therapist on Instagram.
Thank you so much.
And my specialty, I forgot, is African-American family. I use a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy. So you're working with how your thoughts affects your actions. And I like a lot of psychodynamic work as well. So that's kind of what I do. But thank you, Allison, for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. It's been great. Aaron, it's been an absolute pleasure, and I have learned something today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Awesome.
Take care.
Right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Allison J. The journey to here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit AllisonJ.net. That's AllisonJaye.net. Allison with one L, as she is the one and only.